Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
It would be very unprofessional if I said I am not prepared, but so I won't say that. Just kidding. I've been enjoying this While I Have the Mic series. It's been a lot of fun seeing everybody kind of just get, Jenny and I talked about earlier, like what you're passionate about. I think that's pretty cool. And I realized as I was putting this together for this week, I was like, I think I've preached the same sermon every time I've been up here. But I'm kind of in the tradition of the diamond. I'm kind of trying to look at it from a different perspective. So also kind of changing things up a little bit today, I put the mic thing in a different pocket. I had my phone in a different pocket. I sat in a different side of the church, and I'm feeling all weird about it right now. So I don't. We're not superstitious, right? Okay. So going along with that too, I don't usually do this either, but we'll kind of do a little crowd work. So today I'm kind of talking about this idea of enemies and threats to the church. This is something that's been kind of on my radar, and I've been thinking about it a lot. So I'll start off by asking you, maybe get a couple hands up there. Any of you who want to say, what do you think the biggest threat is to the church today?
Ego.
Ego. Okay. Itself. There we go. That's it. Yeah. So, what was that last one?
Greed.
Okay.
Apathy.
Okay. These are good. Good responses. And you know what? Like I said, I was joking and saying that I wasn't prepared. Those were all the ones I kind of expected to hear, which is good. Score one for me. But moving along with that that idea of enemies as I want to talk about today, while I have the mic, I'd like to explore sort of the revolving door cast of characters that have come into my radar as I've grown up in the church and watched. We seem to have in the Big C national sort of American church, we seem to have this constant posting up of the next big enemy. This is the next big threat that we've got to watch out for. And that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. I did see there was a study, I think in 2025, George Barna was asked that question, like what he thinks the biggest issue with the church, or I would say threat. And he said, Christian invisibility in our culture. I think some of us had a different idea that maybe we're a little too visible, and that seems to be the problem. There is, in that statement, and as he unpacks it, he talks about a lack of biblical discipleship, and I land in agreement in some ways, but I think we're probably coming from a different space in that. I think what we disciple people to, or how's that saying go? What you win them with is what you win them to, right? And so this idea of discipleship, what are we bringing them into? Let me go to the first slide here, I think. Perfect. You guys have heard me quote multiple times Jesus and John Wayne, which is a book by Kristen Cobes de May. And that book was so impactful for me. But throughout that book, as she's taking this historical look of the last 100 years or so of the Christian church, at the very beginning, in the opening, she kind of critiques John Eldridge's Wild at Heart, which those of you who are closer to my age or maybe a little older probably got hit pretty heavy with that book when it came out. That book in particular, Wild at Heart, is looking at the battle that men have with just being a man and sexual sin and all that stuff. And I, whenever I quote or say anything up here, I don't want to poo-poo the whole thing. But Kristen Cobes de May's take on John Eldridge's Wild at Heart, I thought was really helpful. She says, Eldridge's God was a warrior, and men were made in the image of this warrior God. Every man needed a battle to fight. And she goes on to say, I soon came to see that a Christian warrior ideal fueled culture wars politics on the home front, and if every man needed a battle to fight, enemies abounded. I would completely agree with that last statement. If every man needed a battle to fight, enemies abounded. in my lifetime, I've seen that revolving door. I've seen the next enemy posted up. I've seen a lot of different versions, and I've seen that need to have that battle. So the overarching question as I kind of pick this apart today, it maybe you guys can ask with me, and it's either good or bad that we have the conversation afterwards, because I don't know that I have any answers to any of these questions. So maybe we're going to talk them out, and maybe we can get a little closer. But the overarching question I would say is, like, do we need to be fighting a battle at all? As I start looking at some of these enemies that have popped up on the forefront in my lifetime, I want to start with what I call the isms, okay? And you can go to the next slide. Okay, so there we go. So spoiler alert, all right. As I started picking apart these enemies and looking at all of the ones that I've seen warned against, you know, the cries that have come out, you've got to watch, this is the next big attack on the church. As I dig deeper into all of these, I find that they start to look more and more like me. And like I said, spoiler alert, that's where it's going to go. Starting with the isms, I've myself been called a Marxist before. So Marxism, kind of under that blanket, we have this idea of communism and socialism. How many of you have heard in some sort of Christian context this threat that socialism or communism has on the church? There we go. Okay. Making sure you guys all know this, I did not do well in government class. I'm not a historian guy or whatever. So what I want to do as I'm looking at this is you guys in the conversation can tell me how wrong I am about this, but I'm breaking it down to the smallest sort of skeleton sort of version of this and kind of pulling out from that idea. Starting with communism and socialism, you know, at its base, you get these ideas of classless, stateless societies. The saying in communism is from each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Socialism, that same sort of idea in there of a collective ownership, trying to reduce inequality by distributing wealth and goods more equitably. As I dig into this, though, like I said, coming from my upbringing, I've heard how dangerous this is, but then I read in Acts where it says, all the believers were united in heart and mind, and they felt that what they owned was not their own. So they shared everything they had. The apostles testified powerfully to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's great blessing was upon them all. There were no needy people among them, because those who owned the land and the houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles to give to those in need. What a dangerous enemy to the church. Let's move on with some other isms. Okay. One of the other ones I've heard a lot is liberalism. And in its basic idea, you hear this idea of liberalism is more looking towards individual freedom, consent of the governed. These are all Wikipedia definitions, so there you go. Equality before the law and protection under protection of individual rights. It's interesting because, yes, like I said, I have seen this framed as a danger to the church. And I understand the argument when you're talking about individual rights versus group, stuff like that. But at the same time, again, I turn to the Bible, and Jesus said to them, the Sabbath was made to meet the needs of the people, not the people to meet the requirements of the Sabbath. Do you guys know this passage? What's going on in there? In that passage, what's going on is the Pharisees are trying to use the law to push down these people who essentially, without going too far into it, who were hungry at the time and needed to eat. I, in my own observation of walking in these circles for so long, have seen this attack on liberalism be used in the same way. These people who are in these marginalized groups or are hurting or are needy, their rights or their needs are squashed under this sort of this call to law, you know, this call to be doing the right thing. And so I look to that example that I just shared with you, and there's something that is right. The Sabbath is right, but we understand it was never meant to squish or hurt or exploit people. So once again, there's another ism enemy. The list keeps going. Let's go with this, guys. Progressivism, if that is an ism. Of course, I've got one marked right here in the Bible, so let's go. Progressivism, that's always been a funny one to me, because this idea of progress being a bad word is just mind, let's go Will Ferrell on it. It's mind-boggling, all right? It doesn't make sense to me, but there is a fear, there is a digging in of the heels that I've experienced in the churches I've come up that says, no, you're moving away, these things are heresy. These ideas for social justice and equality for the marginalized communities have somehow been twisted as being the enemy of what I'm reading in the scriptures here. But let's go right here. Wait, let me just double check my notes so I'm not reading you some totally random passage. Oh, wait. If you guys ever looked at my notes, you would be like, how are you doing this? Your handwriting is not legible at all. In Galatians, okay, in Galatians, there's this basic idea that always gets me. There is no longer Jew or Gentile, slave or free, male or female, for they are all one in Christ Jesus, heirs and God's promise. Wait, they're all one in Christ Jesus. Yeah, in Christ Jesus. That's where it ends. There you go. I can read, I promise. Anyway, if progressivism and moving for equality and justice for everyone is the enemy to the church, why does the scripture, or Paul in the scripture, who so often gets used to present these enemies, why is he saying that there's not these different places, that we're all equal in this? I'm going to keep moving on because that was a little low and we're going to keep going. Postmodernism is a big one. Early 2000s, a really good friend of mine, my best friend was going to Fresno Pacific School, which is a Mennonite school, and his dad got so upset, why did I pay money to send you to a Mennonite school so that you could disagree with all these things that I've taught you for so long? But one of the big things at that time in the early 2000s was there was this resurgence of postmodern ideas coming through the church, and I could be wrong on this, but this is where I believe the term deconstruction started really getting thrown around. And confession, because I want to be totally open and vulnerable to you guys. When my buddy Derek was going to Fresno Pacific and telling me all about reading What Would Jesus Deconstruct and reading John Howard Yoder and these ideas that they were all of a sudden shaking me, and I started getting really nervous and thinking, buddy, you're falling into these dangerous ideas that were a threat to my friend's salvation. And then quickly I dove right down that hole with him. But we see in Acts also, as you look at the early church, we always tout this wonderful thing about the Bereans, right? And I look at that now, and I'm like, yeah, they're taking a look at what they were being given. They were pulling it apart and checking it, deconstructing it maybe, and seeing, is this true? Is this real? I get nervous now when I see people throw that deconstruction term as if it's a danger to the church or as a danger to somebody's salvation, because to me, it seems like such a basic necessity of growing in the Lord and following Jesus. So postmodernism, to me, is not an enemy of the church, but I have heard it described as such. One more easy one to throw out for you, and I don't have any Bible verse to go with this, but feminism. How many of you have heard that held up as the danger to the church? My late mother-in-law, who passed a few years ago, was so awesome. She and I actually, when I read Jesus and John Wayne, I gave it to her to read, and she really liked it because she came up. She was a pastor's wife through that history of all that, and she was like, "Man, this gal who wrote this book has done such a good job citing her sources and everything, but I don't know if she should be saying this stuff. And one of the things that she was critical of or nervous about was the ideas of feminism that were presented in that book. I'll get into this a little further on, but Kristen Cobazamay talks a lot about Phyllis Schlafly and this war against feminism through that history. And the irony to me with my mother-in-law, who was, like I said, so amazing, and again, we'll get into this as I move forward, but her resume, if you really picked it apart, I'm just like, Carol, you're a feminist. Yeah. You didn't know you were doing. She was a designer. She helped design the children's line of clothing for Sears back in the day. But she was working in an element that was or an environment that was not open to women, and she was breaking ground in that. Now, I think if you are being honest and you look through the scriptures, especially in the early church, you will see that the early church and Christianity and Jesus especially himself, but everybody following that, was moving in a direction that was groundbreaking for women as well. And it's unfortunate to me that ideas like feminism get screamed out from pulpits as something you need to squash and be afraid of, because I think if we follow that thread of what was happening in the early church, we should be the most encouraging and empowering group towards women out of anybody else. All right, cool. So those are the isms. Those are ideas. And when we're talking about enemies, it's okay, I think. You guys can help me work on this in the discussion. I think it's okay to kind of question and work through and wrestle with ideas. The danger for me comes with when I say those ideas. Okay, I'm going to use the term figureheads that come to mind. There are people that, I mentioned Phyllis Schlafly, I'll get into that more. There are people that represent that. And there becomes a problem as I wrestle with this idea that I'm against, and then I focus it on that person, and that person becomes my enemy. We know in Ephesians, let's see, it says, we do not battle against flesh and blood, not against the but against the rulers, the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. What's really frightening to me is that verse should be clear to take over what I just said, that we do not need to target a person of flesh and blood and designate them as the enemy. But what I've seen in my time is I've seen that verse twisted and used to make that attack on that person even more powerful. So what I'm going to talk about now as I move on to this enemies thing is I want to talk about what I'm calling, just in this little outline, the enemies at the gate. So since I was a kid, we can kind of move on to the next one. These were some of the enemies at the gate. How many of you came up in or remember the time of the Satanic Panic?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, big time. This one, I use this. I work on my sermons like late at night because I'm a night owl. And this idea of the Smurfs popped in my head because apparently it was super impactful to me as a 6 to 7 year old or whatever. But when I was a kid, I remember going through a time. My parents were sort of young Christians. And I remember going through a time where all of a sudden it's like, hey, you can't watch the Smurfs anymore. The Smurfs are satanic. I'm like, okay, there's Gargamel and Azrael. It's dangerous. It's satanic. The funny part was my dad used to love watching Saturday morning cartoons with me. So while we couldn't watch Smurfs because they were satanic, he and I loved to watch Thundercats and Dungeons and Dragons, which I went back and watched Thundercats recently. It might be satanic. I don't know. So I'm just going to say, but the problem with this is there are these people in the Satanic Panic movement, let's start with that. There were these targets that were affected by this and attacked and hurt that didn't have blue skin and weren't three apples high. There were these people that got really damaged by this movement that said, you know what, there are Satanists that are out there that are coming after your kids. They're putting messages backwards in the music, and they're trying to get you. There's a really interesting podcast. I'm a big podcast guy, but did any of you ever listen to, or did you listen to The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea? Yeah. It was put out by Christianity Today. Mike Cosper did that. The same man who also, another pitch, if you guys do want to listen to podcasts, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill is a big one that Mike Cosper also did with Christianity Today. But in The Devil in the Deep Blue Sea, one of the ideas that that Mike really sheds light on is we had these dangers that were being talked about, and there was a really famous case, I think it was down in Manhattan Beach, is that correct? Yeah, where a preschool, some accusation came out about the satanic practices that were going on. Some of you guys remember it. Well, some of that stuff got sort of lost in time and we forgot. Going back through that podcast was really interesting to see that, like, there was this movement of group misremembering, things were being twisted, kids were being questioned, and ideas were being put into their head. And this one came out just like, and if not more damaging than the Geraldo Rivera going in the basement thing. There was nothing there. An FBI expert, Kenneth Lanning, who's an expert in child sexual abuse and all this stuff, he put out a report in 1992. He published a report that said, out of all these hundreds of cases that went through and all these things that the FBI did investigations on, there was little or no evidence for widespread baby breeding, human sacrifice, or organized satanic conspiracies. But I will say, as a 5, 6, 7-year-old kid going through all that stuff and more, I was so scared. There were times I'd like saw something on the news and then I couldn't go to sleep at night, so I'd run and go and like sleep in my older brother's bed because I was afraid to be, you know, somebody was going to come and kill the sheep out in the field and come after me. But moving along with that, some of these other people groups that have been hurt, these enemies at the gate, I want to kind of look at, well, one of the obvious ones that we've really struggled to kind of reshape the perspective on here, but in my time growing up in the church, I saw the LGBTQ the community, sorry, I can speak, being presented as a danger to the church. Now, when I'm working on this stuff, like when I know what I'm going to be preaching on or teaching on or whatever, I'm brainstorming this stuff all the time. You guys know what I do. I'm sitting there massaging somebody thinking like, okay, how's this going? How's this going to go? And sometimes a lot of my patients and stuff have become really good friends, like family with me. And sometimes we'll talk about these things. So this thing, this topic of enemies, I have an older patient who is, I don't want this to come the wrong way or whatever. She is just the sweetest lady. She has been in the church, grown up through all of it. And she is a sweet, sweet, sweet old lady. But I was talking about my wrestling with the idea of enemies and wondering if we need enemies and if things are being misrepresented in the church. And she, you know, Lord forgive her, like, she's like, well, what about, I mean, you have to think about these, like, there's these gay couples that are, they'll go up into the front of the church and they're just sitting up in front of the church and, like, making out in front of people. And there's kids there and all this time. I was not able to laugh because I'm doing a massage for this person, right? So, but that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. But we have this story that the church has made up about these dangers, that they're out to get you. These people are going to do this. You got to watch out for your kids. Unfortunately, with all of these enemies at the gate that I'm going to talk about, just like the Spider-Man picture, whatever, more often than not, the call is coming from the inside of the house. Do you know who does hurt our kids? Yeah. Let's talk about it. Yeah. I don't even have to say it. If you're online, they all went, uh-huh. So, did any of you guys watch the, there's plenty of documentaries, but, what's the church that does all the worship stuff? Hillsong. Hillsong documentary. That was rough. That was really hard to go through. In the Devil in the Deep Blue Sea podcast, when Mike Cosper pulls through, he is side by side looking at all these accusations that were happening from the satanic groups and everything, or towards the satanic groups, and he's side by side telling stories of these touted, wonderful Christian communities that ended up being filled with dark, dark trauma and bad things that were happening. I don't personally see a community of people who are trying to understand who they love and working through and just being people and loving who they love. I don't see that as being a threat to the church. But I do see plenty of people standing up here where I stand, not this one in particular, hopefully, but who stand up in front of the church who are hurting and damaging people. The call's coming from inside the house. In the same way I said I was going to talk about Phyllis Schlafly, I've heard in my time this idea of strong women being a danger to the church. We see through a lot of interpretation of scriptures saying that women need to be quiet, need to be held down. And in the case of Phyllis Schlafly, it's really fascinating to me. I learned more of this as I was reading about her in Jesus and John Wayne, but it's like, you have this person who is a very strong woman doing big movements, getting up here, making this case that there should not be strong women making big moves, and it's going right over everybody's head, saying like, yeah, no, she's right. And it's like, why are you listening to her? She's a woman. But it keeps moving that way. The call's coming from inside the house. Another one I wrote down as I'm doing my examples, and I know I'm just kind of firing these off. I am part of the generation, actually all of us are, where we watched this movement of the big danger or the big target of the church was going to be abortion and Planned Parenthood. It's fascinating to me as I've learned more and read into that and learned the history of that argument. I've watched so many of people as I came up who their whole voting, their whole political landscape was all based off who's pro-life. This is the biggest danger. We're killing our next generations and we need to stop it. And then as I learned, I realized, oh, that wasn't always the case. Actually, post Roe v. Wade, there was a good time in there still where you can find articles in Christianity Today that were still arguing a pro-choice stance. It's not until, and so many of you guys already know this, but it's not until Bob Jones University starts getting in a little bit of trouble with tax stuff because they don't want to become desegregated, that they make the move to join forces with Billy Graham and that movement with the evangelicals, and through that they form the Moral Majority that starts this whole field that I grew up in of like, oh no, it has to be pro-life or nothing at all. So it's really fascinating to me that we can say this is the enemy when this idea of attacking that enemy was birthed out of something so disgusting and wrong, racism. And then the last one I'll hit on these enemies at the gates because it seems so silly to me, but the latest one I've seen, and with all the lies that go along with it, are this idea of immigrants being the enemy. And literally presented as the enemy at the gate. They're coming right up to the border and it's dangerous. Once again, I'm hit with the irony that there's a movement that we want this to be a more Christian nation, but the reality is most of the people coming up from the southern border, if we let them all in, this would be a totally Christian nation. There's so many Christians trying to get in. There's so many Christians being hurt around the world, but those are the bad ones. I wonder what's different about them. I have no idea. They couldn't look different or anything like that. But so that's a whole list of a bunch of stuff. Like I said, the enemies at the gate, the isms, the call coming from inside the house. And the question I have to ask myself, like I said, first question was, should we be fighting a battle at all? Second question, if I dig into this and these people are starting to look like me and these people are starting to kind of reflect more of the sins that I don't like to see on myself, if that's more what the argument is coming, why am I projecting this outward so much? Why is the church so set on saying those are the bad guys, this us versus them? Are we afraid to look in the mirror? I think the obvious one, or let me say not one, the obvious verse that came up as I was working through this was this Jesus' talk about the plank in the eye. We have that, is that? Yeah. And why worry about the speck in your friend's eye when you have a log in your own? How can you think of saying to your friend, let me help you get rid of that speck in your eye when you can't see past the log in your own eye? Hypocrite! First, get rid of the log in your own eye, and then you will see well enough to deal with the speck in your friend's eye. Are we stuck with a log in our eye so we're not seeing what's going on in our own self? We're not able to look in the mirror, and we're projecting it on somebody else. My thing on this, as I kind of pull it apart, and we're getting close to the close. Maybe God is a warrior God. Maybe John Eldredge was right. Not maybe. I mean, there's plenty of words in this big book that present to some of that stuff. Maybe he is. And maybe there is a battle going on. Lord knows I'm wrestling with stuff all the time. All of us are. But when I take those ideas and I push them towards how I treat the outside world, specifically how I treat people of flesh and blood, it seems to me that if God is a warrior God and there is a battle going on, first of all, I think maybe God is a warrior so we don't have to be. If God is a warrior, then the battle belongs to the Lord, as the song and the scriptures say. And then also, we live in a time where the battle's already been won, according to him. Tetelestai, that's all done. So if God is a warrior God, that doesn't mean that I'm supposed to be going out there looking for a battle to fight. He's already won that battle, supposedly, from what I'm reading in here. We can wrestle with that more in the discussion. But what I see is he tells us to put our swords down. So there doesn't seem to be a call for me to be going out and looking for somebody to fight with. I don't need to be projecting these things that I'm, as I pick this apart, these things that are so disgusting in myself, I don't need to be projecting them onto other communities and looking for a war so that I know who I am. That's scary for some of us. Do we know as Christians who we are if it's beyond we're not them? That's a really tricky thing to me. Because I see so much, all this stuff, when I present this whole thing about enemies and threats to the church, what I've observed beyond all that is the church has identified itself as what it's against. And when it comes to this thing of like, show me what you're for, show me what you are in favor of, what are you trying to build, what are you trying to heal, what do we have to respond to that? Well, so far it's been, well, I'm not that. I'm not that person. I don't do this. I don't do that. It seems to me that's the log that I need to be pulling out. The main battle, if there is a battle for me to fight, it seems to be inside here. It seems to be going on with myself. If I can't tell you who I am without telling you what I'm against and who I'm not, that's a problem for the church. So that's something that we need to wrestle with and kind of work around and see, like, what are we pushing for? Because these isms and these ideas, so many of them are going to be right things to fight against. I gave kind of a convenient list that, if we're being honest, most of you are kind of against those, right? Most of you are not looking at feminism as the biggest danger to the church. If you are, come to the conversation. We're going to talk a little more. But there are those other isms, right? If I'm going to apply this to myself, if you were to ask me outside of, like, you know, if I were not teaching on this right now and I was being totally honest in all my weakness, you'd say, what's a danger to the church? And I would say, well, fascism right now. I do not like being identified in the same groups with that. You guys all know from the few times I've gotten up here, I've moved really into a theology of pacifism. But if you ask me on any day about my pacifism, I say, well, I'll punch a Nazi. I got no problem with that. But that's something that I need to wrestle with. Maybe we can talk about that in the discussion. But for me, some other things, if you're being honest with me, I'm going to say that capitalism, to me, this idea of competition, there's a wonderful band from Sweden that none of you guys are ever going to care about called The Refuse, but they say that capitalism is indeed organized crime. To me, I'm buying into this. I'm listening to the wrong sinful music. But But to me, that is a problem. That is a danger. Racism, obviously, and everything that I listed right now, it tied back to this trail of these racist ideas. That's the real evil, right? That's the real danger. But if I'm going to wrestle this log out of my eye, I have to say, when I tell you about fascists being the enemy, and I close my eyes, who's popping in my head? Who's the picture? Who am I thinking about? I could give you a whole list of people that all work in one specific house of one color. But those things that are popping in my head, those people, that's the problem. Those people that are popping in my head, if they are the enemy, I got to work something out. I'm going to close on this, with that idea. Let's go a little lighter than any serious thing. You guys are always learning a lot about me. This could change from day to day. But my favorite movie of all time is a movie called Gross Point Blank. Have any of you guys ever seen this? Okay. I almost went back at like 1 o'clock in the morning and watched it again last night as I was working this out because I love this movie so much. For those of you who haven't seen Gross Point Blank, Gross Point Blank is a film about Martin Blank, who is a professional assassin. He left on prom night of his in high school to go join the army. Well, I'll get into that a little more. But he became a professional assassin. Now, throughout this movie, he's hit with this dilemma of being invited back to his high school reunion. He's seeing his therapist and wrestling through all these things, which Dr. Altman, his therapist, says, maybe all this stuff you're struggling with has to do with the idea of killing a lot of people. And he says, I don't think what you do for a living defines who you are. So anyway, so he's coming back to his high school reunion, wrestling with this idea of being a trained killer, and hoping to work things out with the girl he left on prom night, Miss Debbie Newberry. Now, as you guys have heard me talk about how music goes through my head as I'm working these things out, whatever. First off, the soundtrack of this movie was put together by Joe Strummer, who's a singer for The Clash. You guys know how I feel about The Clash. That might be why this is a really important movie to me. But secondly, as I was working through all this stuff, the story of Martin Blank like took a whole new idea for me, or a whole new twist. Because in the movie, this man who's so detached from the work he's doing, he's just going out and killing people, he's lost a taste for it. He's not very creative at work anymore. Things are, yeah. What'd he say, you know, trouble with concept execution, it's not working. He tried to like drip poison down a thread while a guy was sleeping, it didn't work out, he had to shoot him in the head. It was this whole mixed up thing. But as you get to the climax of this movie, at the very end, there are these killers coming after him. He's with Debbie and her dad. They're on the run after all these killers, and he's having to fight them off, and he explains his whole point through this. He explains why he went in that direction at all. He says, I was sitting alone on prom night in that GD, I'm trying not to cuss from the pulpit anymore, in that GD rented tuxedo, and my whole life flashed before my eyes, and I realized finally and for the first time that I wanted to kill somebody. So I figured since I love you so much, it'd be a good idea if I didn't see you anymore. But then they move on. There's more people shooting at him. He's going with this stuff. And then he explains, and this is what caught me, and this is the thing that shifted everything for me on my viewpoint on this movie, but kind of tying into the sermon. He says, so I was in the Gulf last year. I was doing this thing. Anyway, it doesn't matter. And I came over this dune, and I saw the ocean, and it was on fire, the whole thing on fire, and it was beautiful. So I just sat there, and I watched it. And that's when I realized there might be a meaning to life, you know, an organic power that connects all living things, God, Yahweh, I don't know. That's what shifted him. You guys should watch the movie. The funny part, when my wife and I were first dating, I showed her this movie because I loved it so much. She was falling asleep on the couch and started complaining that there were too many gunshot noises. So I was like, oh, this is not her thing. But then later in marriage, I found out that one of her all-time favorite movies is Predator. So that really threw me off. But back to Gross Point Blank. This idea of a connectivity, that all living things are connected, and I say God, Yahweh, Martin Blank says, I don't know, something like that. But there's something that's connecting us all. That's the That's the main conflict that is working within me as I put a face to those isms and those threats and all those bad things. As I put a face to that, when I realize that I'm connected with that person, whatever name is popping in your head, I'm connected to them, I don't get to hold them in the position of enemy anymore. We have the greatest example of all with the incarnation, that God shows us meeting each other in that humanity in order to heal and not kill. If I'm going to rip this log out of my eye, if I'm going to wrestle through and work through that, the point of me doing it is not so I can see better to get them in my sights. The point of me to do that is so that I can help to heal and move forward. So if we're going to identify more with what we're for, then we need to see that connected humanity in everybody. And we are undoing, I would say, as Martin Luther would say, undoing the enemyhood of these people. So that's all I got for today. We can talk about it more in the discussion, but I think if there is a battle to fight, it's inside ourselves. And if we do have enemies out there, we need to start seeing them as other human beings. That's pretty basic, yeah? Good deal.